Hello, I'm Luke Broadwater, and I am a State House reporter at the Baltimore Sun.
And I'm Malia Cromer, pollster and political science professor at Goucher College. And this is Roughly Speaking, Government Edition, a Baltimore Sun podcast where each week during legislative session, we take a closer look at the policy, people, and places that shape our state government.
This week, we're going to talk with Senator Justin Reedy. Senator Reedy is a Republican representing Maryland's 5th District in Carroll County.
In this episode, we'll get to know Senator Reedy and his district a little better and also get his views on the Republican legislative priorities. But first, we're going to take a closer look back at the Baltimore Sun reporting this past week. Governor Hogan gave his State of the State address, and the Democrats laid out their own legislative agenda.
Yes, it was yet another busy week in Annapolis. And to discuss those competing priorities between the Republicans and the Democrats, I'm going to bring on my State House colleague, Pamela Wood of The Sun. Okay, I'm joined by my colleague in the State House Bureau, the talented Pamela Wood. We've seen the House Republicans put forward their package of legislation. We've seen the Democratic leadership put forward their initiatives. And then last week we heard Governor Hogan put forward a bunch of new ideas from him. He did this at the State of the State speech. Pamela was there in the chambers at the State House. Set the scene for us. What is it like to be at a State of the State address?
The State of the State is an annual speech given by the governor, and much like the inauguration, it has a lot of ceremony and drama to it, but thankfully this is done indoors. and it's in the House of Delegates chamber. It's a joint session between the House and the Senate. So the senators all proceed over across the hall from the Senate chamber. And there is a formal party of senators and delegates who escort in the lieutenant governor and then the governor. And it's, you know, all eyes on the governor. And he stands, you know, up in front of the House chamber. It's packed. There's a bunch of visitors, county executives. We had one former governor there, Governor Glenn Denning. And, of course, more media than you usually have on an average day in Annapolis. So I was squeezed along a wall in the corner watching the speech.
Not the most comfortable accommodations.
Yeah. Well, that's part of the job, getting it done. And for those who like to find symbolism in attire, the governor wore a blue and red striped tie, for what it's worth. He did purple on the inauguration. He did blue and red. And actually, he had a moment at the beginning of the speech where the teleprompter briefly went out.
At my inauguration in 2015, I said that the politics that have divided our state need not divide our nation. The teleprompter just went out. So I'm going to read the speech. How about that?
You know, anybody who speaks as much as the governor, you know, any governor really can power through. And so he referred to his notes for a little bit, and then it got the teleprompter got started working again.
And what would you say the main themes of the speech were?
The main theme of the speech, whereas the inaugural speech was a little more high ideas, this is basically a to-do list for lawmakers. So he ran through some of the things that he said were his accomplishments and, you know, great things he's done. And then he talked about some of the things he wants to do moving forward. He advocated for his idea of an accountability office in the State Department of Education that would basically root out corruption or respond to reports of corruption in local schools. This is, of course, inspired in part by Baltimore County, which had a former school superintendent go to jail. He also talked about some of his tax cuts. And 2 days prior, he had said he was going to unveil a major tax cut. That's not quite what worked out, but he does have a package of tax cut proposals for making student loan debt not taxable on your state taxes, expanding a little bit what types of retirement income are not taxed, and also some business-focused taxes for opportunity zones. Those are federally designated areas where they want to spur development and redevelopment. So it's some state tax incentives that would complement the federal benefits. So that was the gist of his speech, basically kind of outlining his priorities for Sessions.
And if you add all those tax cuts up, it's about $100 million a year. And it seems like a lot of it is emphasized on retirees.
Right. Yeah. There's not a broad-based tax cut for all of us. I don't think I would qualify for any of the ones he's proposing. So it is very targeted tax relief.
And then
if he gets it passed. Now, these are proposals that have to go through the House, the Senate, and become law. And I'm not sure that we're going to see all of these become law.
And then speaking of that, he's in the Democratic-controlled General Assembly. He's a Republican. He's talking tax cuts. He's maybe chastising them a little bit for not being tough enough in his view on crime. How is this speech received as you're sitting there with all the lawmakers around you?
I think it actually was received relatively well, even by Democrats. Some of them, I think, were bracing that he was going to have some new proposal, some giant tax cut proposal or something that they would oppose. So the fact that he ran down a list of things that they already knew about, I think, was a little bit of a sigh of relief for Democrats. And he made some entreaties towards bipartisanship again, which, of course, they always say that they like. Some Republicans wanted him to go a little further. They want to see more tax relief. But that was, I mean, a very minor criticism from the Republicans.
We did our very best to put the people's priorities ahead of the current national obsessions with partisanship while striving to change Maryland for the better. And as a result of those efforts, I'm pleased to report that the state of our state has never been stronger and that the people of Maryland are more encouraged about the direction of our state than they have ever been.
So we have the Republicans on the right saying go bolder on taxes. We have the Hogan plans. And but then we have the Democratic-controlled plans. I mean, this is the plans that will probably pass. This is the plans that usually rule the day. So the Democrats came forward and they put forward their joint priorities from the state, from the Senate and the House. What are some of the highlights?
Right. Yeah, we had a press conference with House Speaker Mike Bush and Senate President Mike Miller together with so many delegates and senators. They were crowded behind them. They have several priorities that they promise they are going to pass. One of them is a $15 minimum wage. The minimum wage is currently $10.10, and there's a proposal to bring it up gradually to $15. They say they're going to pass it. The question is in what form, all the way to $15, you know, some of the exemptions. We also have an expansion of a child care tax credit that would make more people eligible for it, so to help offset the high cost of child care. They also want to ban 3D printed guns and ghost guns, which is a new term for me. These are basically kits that you can buy and have sent to you, and you can make a gun. It's about 80% of a gun, and then you just go buy a couple more parts. So Democrats, not a fan of those. They also want to raise the minimum wage for buying tobacco from 18 to 21. That's a priority of the Black Caucus as well. They also want to make it in Maryland law something in the Affordable Care Act, which is that you can't discriminate based on pre-existing conditions. They're afraid that's going to go away under the Affordable Care Act. And also creating a state board that would monitor prescription drug prices. And last of all, the foam ban, which is, you know, your foam coffee cups, your foam carryout containers, a ban on those in the state of Maryland.
So these are the seven main priorities, and they are agreed upon only in concept,
right
between the
principle.
House and the Senate. So we've yet to see the details, correct? And a lot could the devil's in the details, as they say, right?
Right. So some of these are in as bills. We have seen the bills on them. But just because a bill gets introduced one way doesn't mean it's going to come out the other end of the legislative process looking exactly the same. So that's what we're going to be watching, you know, through the remainder of the session, if they follow through on their promises to pass these and what the final version looks like.
Pamela Wood from the Sun State House Bureau. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And now let's move on to a discussion with the Sun's investigative reporter, Doug Donovan. Doug had the duty last week of fact-checking the State of the State speech. Doug. Doug was our political editor for what, like half a year?
Last year during the General Assembly session and the primary campaign.
And now you return to reporting.
I have, yes.
And one of the things you did last week for the politics team was you fact-checked Governor Larry Hogan's State of the State speech.
Right. Always a great assignment to have to fact-check the chief executive of the state who has a speech written for him and researched by a team of people and have to be the one guy to go out and fact-check it, including yourself, of
right,
course.
Sure,
but
yeah.
I mean, that's what we do, and it's a good assignment because you want to let the readers know what exactly is true in a speech and what is hyperbole. And as we know, politicians are quite often
yes, prone to hyperbole. I've yet to meet the politician who does not repeatedly cite inaccurate statistics that make them look better.
Like, so. I can't think of one actually right now, but I'm just kidding.
So. Let's get down to business. And I think it's important to do this not just because of what's in one speech, but these are often claims that the governor makes repeatedly, and so it's good for people to know the facts. The first thing that he says a lot of the time is the governor had some claims about overdose deaths.
And while we have bent the curve downward on prescription opioid and heroin overdose deaths, an even more deadly drug, fentanyl, is infecting and poisoning America.
What do the facts say about that?
Well, it's accurate in that they have bent the curve downward on prescription opioids and heroin specifically, but a little bit beyond their control, as he alludes to here, is the fentanyl, which really took everyone by surprise from when he came into office until now. I mean, fentanyl back in 2014 was involved in some 186 overdose deaths. And by last year, by 2017, it was found in 1,000, almost 1,600 overdose deaths. So fentanyl flooding the market has really put the overdose fatalities way up. But it is true that heroin's come down and overdose deaths from prescription opioids has come down, which was the original target for everybody. And they were able to do a lot of prescription drug monitoring and supervision of doctors and a lot of education on overprescribing. And I think that's really paid off, which is good. But at the same time, they get hit with this fentanyl scourge that's really hit the whole country.
So as we look at these rising terrible overdose statistics, there is some signs of success with some of the overdose categories, but just not with the overall number.
Yeah, over from like 2016 to 2017, but heroin and prescription drug overdose deaths are still up from when he first came into office.
And then he repeated a favorite topic of his, which is to say he has record-funded education.
For the fifth year in a row, my budget provides historic, record-high funding for our schools. We've invested $32 billion in K-12 education. Every single school system in Maryland will again see increased investment by the state.
Yeah. How does that stand up to the facts?
I mean, when you say you record-funded education, pretty much anybody who's governor can say that. Each year, as enrollment goes up, so does the formulas that fund education. And so each year it gets higher and higher and higher. So in essence, yes, you are, you know, recording record funding for schools. Now, at the same time, the governor's office says, well, he does have some power to reduce funding below what the formulas say, and he hasn't done that, and he's actually gone over the formulas in many cases. But at the same time, there's been reports by the Department of Legislative Services that have said that the city schools themselves are technically been underfunded if you were to follow the Thornton formula. By its original, how it was originally written, they're underfunded by about $290 million. And we're talking about school construction. We still have schools without heat, air conditioning, or, you know, reliable heat and air conditioning. That's a thing every year that students have to put up with.
Yeah, I mean, it would be illegal, right, to not record fund education almost,
right.
Unless there was a huge drop in the student population. But you're right. He has stepped in, and especially this year with the city schools, added $11 million to the budget when they would have had a cut from the formula. And then there was one thing that I don't think we got to in the written version of the fact check, but we had both been looking into, and that is the governor had some comments about the General Assembly not doing enough about gun sentencing.
Last year, inexplicably, we were unable to get legislation passed to impose tougher mandatory sentences for those who repeatedly commit violent crimes with guns. We're talking about taking our communities back and saving lives. Enough is enough. The time has come.
And he sort of chastised the assembly for not passing a bill that he wanted that would increase the mandatory minimum sentence for a repeat crime of violence with a gun to 10 years. The General Assembly came back and said, "We did pass that bill, Governor."
Right. It was a strange moment in the speech. Yeah. I mean, he built his speech up from the very, very beginning as being, you know, bipartisan. Everyone's getting along. Democrats and Republicans in Annapolis are, you know, a model for what should be going on in Washington, D.C. And then out of nowhere, he hits with this mandatory minimum thing. And it just struck everybody as odd because they did do a mandatory minimum for violent crimes committed with guns last year. So it was surprising. And I would say it's not factual because they did pass something very similar to what he said. It's just not exactly what he wanted.
Right. And so and the distinction here is, right, there's two bills, right? They're two slightly different bills. One passed, the other didn't.
Right.
The one he wanted didn't pass, but the assembly passed one that had some very minor differences. I think it's like whether drug dealing counts as a triggering offense for the second conviction.
Right, and to me, that's sort of the compromise between Democrats and Republicans that he's bragging about. And I feel like the bill that did pass last year came to a compromise from both sides. And instead of touting that, he wants to sort of chastise the legislature for not doing exactly what he wanted.
And so, summing up, having gone through this speech line by line, how do you think it stands up overall? Is it largely factual? Are there some big problems with it? What do you think?
No, I think it's largely factual. I think it was a good speech. I think people are hungry for bipartisan cooperation, so he does a good job of selling that. People who are in the nitty-gritty like yourself, people down in Annapolis who cover this day-to-day, know that that's not always true, obviously. But I think it helps him nationally if he's going to go forward and try to run for president to, you know, strike that bipartisan tone. Whether or not that matters much for this General Assembly session, I don't know, because this is his last 4-year term, so you may see a more aggressive Democratic Party trying to get what they want from a Republican governor they know won't be around in 4 years.
Great. Doug Donovan, the Sun's investigative reporter. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
So, Dr. Cromer, we have heard from the House Republicans and their agenda. We've heard from the Democrats who control the General Assembly and their agenda. And we've heard from Governor Hogan. Which issues are you watching this session?
So I'm forever interested in the way that public opinion shapes these debates that we're having in the state legislature, especially if it's on something that we've never asked about before on the Goucher poll. So something that I'm watching really closely is this ban on styrofoam containers. It brings together, I think, a really interesting conversation about government regulation as well as environmental issues. Our polls in the past have really indicated that we're a really pro-environment state. People are particularly conscientious about the Chesapeake Bay, and that's certainly one of the reasons they'd like to ban these styrofoam containers is to stop them from getting into our waterway. So we'll be watching that, definitely this legislative session. And I'm always interested, particularly with the Republicans laying out a set of tax cuts with this sort of push and pull between Marylanders' support for increasing funding for education, but also the view that they pay way too much in taxes. And that's something that we've consistently found through the Goucher poll.
And are we going to be seeing any more polling on these topics?
You better believe it. So the styrofoam container ban will certainly be on our upcoming Goucher poll, and we'll be seeing those results in the next few weeks.
And how are you wording the questions, if I might ask?
Oh, that's a tough one. So I've been going back and forth on what what's actually – so the, it'll be a support or oppose the ban on styrofoam containers, and then I'll probably give an example of the containers that we're planning – that the legislature is planning on banning. So that's where it gets a little bit tricky.
And what is polling showed in the past? Have we seen polling on styrofoam among Marylanders?
No, not among Marylanders. I've actually never seen this question asked among Marylanders. I'm sure that maybe perhaps a special interest group has maybe paid for polling for this. But as far as I know, there's no independent polling done on this particular topic. Now, we have in the past with the Goucher poll asked about different environmental issues. We asked about hydraulic fracturing. We asked about people's perceptions of how concerned they are with health of the bay. We asked about offshore wind. And again, a pretty pro-environmental lean of the state. This is, but this is an issue that sort of intersects with styrofoam ban, at least with government, with people's perceptions of government oversight as well. And so this is why it's a really great issue to ask about.
Yeah, and then the taxing issue will be interesting because people always respond that they feel overtaxed, but then they always want the services when that's asked that way too. So
that's right. By and large, we've asked about this question several times in the Goucher poll in the past, and this is the idea of like how much do we want to spend for education? And people are always like, yes, more money for public education. But at the same time, on the same poll, we'll ask how much to them to give perceptions of their tax burden, and they all say they're taxed too much, and so. Every government service comes at a cost to the Maryland taxpayer, and how the legislature will message and sort of balance those two, I think, is the part of the budget that I think is most interesting. All right, well, that brings us to our guest today, Senator Justin Reedy, a Republican representing Maryland's 5th District. Welcome to Roughly Speaking, Senator Reedy.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so you first served in the House of Delegates from 2011 to 2015, and then you were appointed to fill a vacancy in the Maryland State Senate in 2016. You went on to win the District 5 Senate seat this last election cycle with about 70% of the vote. And you've also even had a one-year stint as the executive director of the Maryland Republican Party. Now, in your district, Governor Hogan won about 86%, and then-candidate Trump won about 68%. And so do you think your district is a little bit more MAGA, or is it more Change Maryland?
Well, in a general election, I think it's probably more Change Maryland. I think in a primary, it may be more MAGA, although I think they're both President Trump and Governor Hogan are very, very, very popular. It kind of depends on maybe who you talk to, who they love more, but it's an interesting dichotomy sometimes.
Absolutely. So thinking about those voters in your district, what are their core values? What really motivates them to vote?
I think people really want to, generally speaking, want to be – they want smaller, limited government. They want one of the big challenges we have in our county is that we are very easy for people to move up to Pennsylvania and still commute to the same job. They pay lower taxes. Their houses are cheaper. Now, they get to Pennsylvania sometimes and find out there's a bunch of little individual taxes in the little town they moved to they didn't know about. But even so, their house is $50,000 or $60,000 cheaper. And so that's our challenge is when we have a high cost of living and higher tax burden relative to our neighbors. Carroll County is often – we see it in declining enrollments with our students. We have less students in our public schools than we did a decade ago. So I think taxes are drive it. Certainly, we're very much a pro-Second Amendment, pro-hunting, pro-firearm county. People like that. People have grown up with it, and even beyond the belief of it being a constitutional right for self-defense, there's also that just culturally, people are used to them, and they can't understand why people are afraid of firearms. And in fact, I feel like I spend a lot of time in Annapolis explaining to people that want to make it harder for just an average law-abiding citizen to go buy a firearm. I spent a lot of time explaining, you know, you guys you're barking up the wrong tree. Maybe we'll talk about that later. But so that firearms, you know, that freedom to do that, taxes, but at the same time also, we're a county that just really values, I think, family and there's a lot of things. Obviously, I love my district. Everybody says their district's the best, but we really do a lot to take care of ourselves and our community. So it's a great place for people to spend time.
So we'll get back to some of the policy issues in a minute. But so this idea of agricultural tourism.
Yes.
And I looked through on your website, and I noticed that you are a really – it's one of your priorities is to find a way to promote agriculture in district, and that includes agricultural tourism.
Absolutely.
Can you tell our listeners a little bit about what that all entails?
Well, it's really a – you know, farms, to be successful in Maryland, agriculture and agriculture producers are having to find creative ways to do that. because we have a lot of – we don't have a lot of these – you know, you hear about these giant corporate huge farms out in the Midwest. That's not really what we have much in Maryland. We certainly have some of that. But a lot of it is people who have are farming, and it may even be a second livelihood for them. They may have another job and then also be farming, and that's not their main job. Or they may be supporting their farm by having another job, maybe a better way to put it. So we've seen a real explosion in wineries in our county. Also, we've made some changes to our laws to make it easier for people to do like weddings and events at farms. Obviously, there have to be certain types of zoning requirements and changes. So we've had to be sensitive to figuring all that out, but we're making progress on really wanting people to come out and see what farming is like. I mean, I talked earlier about my colleagues in the General Assembly. One of the challenges we sometimes face when we talk about environmental policy and farming regulations is people that say they're pro-farmer, but their idea of farming is someone growing arugula in their backyard. And they don't understand. Sometimes they'll put these certain kinds of restrictions on a farm that aren't going to have that much positive environmental benefit, but are going to be very difficult for a small farmer or a local farmer. So anytime we can get more people to understand, make sure kids understand where milk actually comes from and eggs and things like that, it's really important because a lot of times kids grow up thinking that, meat comes from the store. So that's all very important. And as I said, wineries, breweries, but not just alcohol, even other types of operations to try to come up with some unique ways for these farms to be profitable.
So we're talking anywhere from like petting zoo to pumpkin patch all the way to breweries. That's all agricultural tourism.
But we still have plenty of conventional agriculture. We have close to $100 million in economic activity that's in Carroll County agriculture, whether it's beef farms, produce, dairy, although dairy is struggling all over the state. Dairy, I mean, so it's a good, you know, there's a lot of, still a lot of conventional economic activity.
Okay, I would love to talk about farmers markets and corn for at least another 15 minutes, but I had to turn it over to my my co-host Luke, and he's going to get into the policy.
For some tough questions.
Some little tougher questions.
So I wanted to get with you a little bit about your legislative priorities. We've seen the House Republicans put forth their agenda. We've seen the governor put forth his. We've seen the Democratic leadership. But I don't think we've seen the Senate put forward its own agenda. Where do you think you fall? Are you more with the governor and what he wants to do? Are you more with the House?
Well, I think what the House put forward, generally speaking, particularly as it relates to taxes, was really not in contrary to what the governor put forward. I think it's sort of a tandem effort. I like the House's income tax relief proposal, and certainly I think I'm 100% on board with redistricting, and I do think, and it's more of a House issue because it's delegate districts, but single member districts, to me, it's sort of unconscionable we still have these multi-member districts. It's a very bizarre – we're one of only two states that still does this whole multi-member district thing. So I think that I love the redistricting proposal as far as that goes. I think sometimes it's easy for people to want to try to drive a wedge between sort of the governor and Republican caucus in either the House or Senate. The Senate has tended to traditionally not do a big – even since before I got there – Senate works a little differently. Each member is a little more of a independent contractor kind of, whereas in the House you're more of a team. And I say that because I've been in both, and I'm not saying either one's bad or good. We in the Senate last year did roll out a series of potential proposed changes on the income tax situation with the federal government, and I don't think we may roll out something jointly again. We did not roll out a whole, like, this is our Republican Senate legislative agenda per se. Certainly, I think we're working to help the governor move his agenda through. Tax relief, very important. Also, sitting on Judicial Proceedings Committee in the Senate, we have four Republicans on that committee. And crime, law and order, criminal justice, obviously huge issues this session. I don't think I come down on either side. I think both have really good points of what we want to push forward. I don't think there's anything in conflict, with it. So.
Except for the if you passed all of it, it would be quite a hit to the budget, perhaps.
Well, I think a small reduction in the income tax would actually be a great driver for economic growth. We've seen that nationally. As much as people like to bash the president for a lot of different things, I don't think any independent economic observer can't say it's not been a positive economically. The tax relief. And so in Maryland, unfortunately, some of that passed us by because we have these sort of outdated way of income tax codes. So I'd like to see us do a little bit more to relieve the burden on Marylanders. It is true you probably can't pass 8 different tax cuts. You'd have to probably pick one or two. I think if the House's income tax cut got to the governor's desk, I think he'd sign it. But
I suspect he might as well. So keeping with taxes, I've been getting a lot of calls the past couple of weeks from people who are now doing their taxes in Maryland.
Imagine that.
And people are saying, hey, I thought the General Assembly took care of this. I got a 9% tax cut from the feds, and I'm doing my taxes, and it's a 20% tax increase on the state side. Mm-hmm. What's going on here?
Well, as I mentioned, you know, last year the Senate Republicans, and I think the House Republicans also, rolled out. We wanted to fix it completely to where what's happening is I think the issue is when people itemize with the feds, they end up in trouble with the state. Typically, most people are not paying more net in their taxes because of the federal cut, but their state taxes are going up. And what we wanted to do was try to pair those itemizations together to allow people to pick and choose whether they want to itemize in one and not the other, depending on what was more advantageous for them. That's a simplification. There were some other proposals, too, to try to – and we never could get the Republicans, and some – frankly, some Democrats were on board with it, too, but we never could get enough support to the fix that ended up happening didn't take care of everybody. Took care of some people, but not everybody. And the governor signed it because it was better than what we started out with, but I think it was – unfortunately, a missed opportunity for the General Assembly to really kind of zero it out and let everybody take full advantage of the federal tax benefit. So now that people are doing their taxes, they're like, wait a minute, you know, depending on what income bracket they're in and how they itemize. So it's still something we could fix, you know, and I think it would have been a good opportunity. That's why it was funny when the governor talked about the President Trump's tax cut, people first thought he was criticizing Trump, but he was actually saying, well, here in Maryland, I don't want anybody to have to pay more in taxes. We should fix our tax code. And what you saw was there's a certain point where the folks that control Annapolis, the Democrats and the General Assembly, as a party, don't want to have people keep more of their money typically. They always find a reason why we need to have higher taxes. And sometimes those reasons can sound very good, but I think it's best when we empower people economically to have a little more of their money to keep. It tends to lead to a lot more economic growth. So
do you think we'll see – I think the bill is in – that would do what failed to do last year in terms of a lower tax rate when people are itemizing
yeah,
in the state.
Yeah.
And do you see any prospects for that this year?
Well, I would love to say yes. I don't know. And it's in the early stages. I think, you know, the Senate in the past has passed an income tax cut back in 2016. And the House kind of hemmed and hawed. And I think they passed something, but they weren't identical and we couldn't get it through. I think there's maybe a little more hope in the Senate than the House, but I'm not sure right now. I'd love to see it.
Let's move to the issue of crime, particularly crime in Baltimore. We're here in the city. You sit on judicial proceedings. We've seen some competing proposals, some stuff coming from the governor. Mm-hmm. What do you think needs to be done about Baltimore crime?
Well, look, I think clearly we can talk about the systemic and cultural issues that have – because every time we talk about crime in Baltimore, there are people who rush to say, yeah, but you don't understand. The problem is deeper than that. And I think we all agree there are deep issues fundamentally with Baltimore, and it's not the only area like that in the country, but Baltimore certainly stands out. But I think ultimately, right now, we've got people getting shot on the street. It's not just the murders; it's the crime. I mean, it's crime in general. And you know, what we tend to see is rallies about banning guns you can print out of a printer that have never been used in a crime before. But we've got repeat violent offenders that use firearms and are not doing any serious jail time. We have people who've murdered somebody, and both the person that's been murdered and the murderer, allegedly murderers, the murderers have been arrested multiple times for all sorts of crimes, including oftentimes crimes with guns. So my attitude is if you're worried about gun safety and gun crime and guns in general, we ought to be locking up the people. If you commit a crime with a gun, particularly it's the second time, there should be a hard time associated with that. We tried to get that last year. I'm actually a guy who's worked. I know there's a philosophical belief that mandatory minimums are bad in general because it removes judicial discretion. And I actually I've agreed with some of that. Certainly on drug crimes and nonviolent crimes, we've gotten rid of a lot of those mandatory minimums with justice reinvestment because we want to emphasize that people get into treatment or get help or, you know, use that higher sentence as a stick to make people take advantage of, you know, the carrot of rehabilitation or whatever. But we ultimately, when people continue to use a gun and commit crimes, commit violent crimes of any kind, but particularly when you're using a firearm that way, we've got to send a strong message that it's not going to be tolerated. And right now, what they're getting in Baltimore is lots of toleration. I mean, that's just flat out what's happening. And so I'm very passionate about – I've been a strong supporter of criminal justice reform, but I also – like part of that is making sure we have really good sentences for violent crime because we should be – people that we are afraid of or the community is afraid of need to be in jail. And that's what's not happening in Baltimore right now.
And then on the issue of guns, which you brought up, I take it you're opposed to the 3D printing ban and the ghost gun ban, as they call it. And
I would like to see rallies in Annapolis from the groups that want to make it harder and harder for anybody to have, you know, they want to do background checks on hunting rifles, which have basically never been used or rarely used. Now, obviously, you know, there's a very high-profile situation. That guy never should have been able to do what he did, though. There was a lot of checks that
were
never –
You're talking about the shooting at the Capitol Gazette.
Yeah, I mean, but in generally speaking, there have been precious few crimes ever committed with a long gun. So you're going to make somebody in my district wait a long time to buy a firearm they've used since they were a kid because while you have this rampant crime with illegal handguns in Baltimore and you're letting people out on the streets all the time. Oh, but if you're in Baltimore and you're somebody who's been trained to use a firearm and you want to buy a handgun and have a concealed carry permit for your protection, you live in the most dangerous neighborhood in Baltimore and you can show I've been trained, you can't get one. You can't get one. Because we've made it so difficult to get a concealed carry permit. I just think that's wrong. And but I know there are people who are very afraid of guns. And certainly, as I told you at the start of our podcast, you know, in my county, people grew up using firearms, but they respect them. They were taught to, you know, respect them and use them properly. And so the disconnect for me is very stark.
Where did you fall on the red flag law last year?
I worked very hard on that bill. I did vote against it in the end. I thought we came out with the bill as it passed the House had a lot of problems with it. By the time we were done really working on it in the Senate, and I give our chairman Bobby Zuerken credit and because he brought everybody to the table and we worked together to work on that bill to make it tighter. Fundamentally, I still felt like there's a due process issue at the front end where. Without somebody ever doing anything wrong or doing anything that rises to the level of law enforcement being able to execute an emergency protection order, you're taking their firearms away and making them prove that they're not dangerous. Now, I understand why people want that because they want to prevent suicide and things like that. What I've seen is they've seized a lot of these firearms. They haven't really proven that they've saved a lot of lives. They, you know, certainly you don't always know what would happen if they'd let that person, those 148 people keep the firearm. But ultimately, I felt like the due process issue, due process issues, where I come down is, we can't say we're going to take a right away from you because you might be dangerous, and I think that's a big issue for me. I will say I thought the bill that passed, because the NRA actually removed their opposition by the time we were done with it, because we had taken out a lot of issues like they were going to let ex spouses come in and. You know, say that you might be dangerous. There was a lot of issues that we were able to work out and say you got to have a direct relationship with the person or be law enforcement or be a medical professional. But what I don't think came out enough in that whole discussion was there were already things you can do to say that someone's dangerous and go in and intervene. There was a little bit of a donut hole where it's like, well, they haven't made a threat officially and they haven't done anything criminal and they're not. You know, they're not out of their mind or having a mental crisis. But there's this little donut hole. There's like, well, they seem to be – they're not mentally unstable, but they might be having a crisis. I used the wrong word. They might be having a crisis or it could make them do something. I just felt like there was a lot of gray area there that could be problematic. So I did vote against it. But I did feel like we got it to where it was a tighter bill by the end of the debate.
Do you think the red flag law could have helped with the case of the Capitol Gazette?
I don't know, and I confess I read about the case at the time. I don't know. That's a good question. I don't know because I don't know who would have necessarily known to report him because the Capitol Gazette editor or someone would not have been able to use the red flag law.
Right, but could have gone to the, they could have gone to the police and.
Yeah, I see. I feel like I'd love to. That's an interesting thing to look into. Quite honestly, I don't know, because there seemed to be some evidence that this guy was pretty unstable already that wasn't followed up on, and because they just wanted to drop it. And I'm not saying that to be negative. I understand they kind of wanted it to go away. So that's a good question. I don't know. I don't know.
And what's the bill you most want to see passed?
Well, I have a bill, and I'm actually going to be doing a little bit of a tandem thing to it as well, but I have a bill on fetal homicide that after the Wallen case in Howard County where the teacher was unfortunately, sadly, murdered by a boyfriend and murdered after a sonogram, and they'd been off and on for 10 years. He did not want her to have a baby, and he wanted to be free of that of her and that responsibility. He murdered her in cold blood, but the baby, you were not able to charge for the death of Reed. They'd given the baby a name. And because Reed was not at viability yet, and I wanted to see us change the law to where if someone knowingly commits a murder in that case, it shouldn't matter what age the fetus or the baby is at. It should be able to be a murder charge, because if the woman had maybe, you know, survived, and it happens more often than just this one case. So we're working on changing that law. It's a little bit of a heavy lift because sort of abortion politics come into it, which I've tried to keep out. We also want to do something to where we can maybe protect pregnant women in general the way we protect some other classes of people. So because there's actually a lot of statistically, it's not raw numbers, but statistically it's actually murder is like the number one cause of death of pregnant women in Maryland, believe it or not. It's not a high – it's not like hundreds of people, but it's statistically – it beats car accidents in Maryland. So wow. It's really weird. People don't know that. And I didn't know until I got into all this. So that's actually something really important to me. I have two children of my own, but it's just because I think that's really important. So and I'm seeing some good collaboration on that. So I hope we can get something done on that this session.
Senator Justin Reedy, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Okay. That's all we have for this week on Roughly Speaking Government Edition. We hope you'll join us next week or continue to change Maryland for the better through common sense, nonpartisan podcasting.
And that's a proper Hogan reference there. Thanks for joining us. And a big thank you to producer Steve Early and Hallie Miller. If you like what you heard, please find us and subscribe. And while times change, the need for quality journalism doesn't. So please consider subscribing to the Baltimore Sun at www.baltimoresun.com. Thanks, and see you next week.